Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Sometimes it's hard to talk about race.
It's so hard to even talk about. Maybe I shouldn't talk about it, but I am.
That's an audibly confused Chris Matthews trying to explain his feelings about watching Barack Obama deliver the State of the Union. And as David Walrice said on our show yesterday, it could be a sign that people are beginning to think about race in a new way.
And I do think that he's working through it. I don't think this is the first time he's said something like this. I think he's negotiating and working through it. And from a psychological perspective, I think that's healthy. And I think it's healthy that we have this kind of dialogue.
That may be healthy, but perhaps he shouldn't have said this.
You know, I forgot he was black tonight for an hour.
Healthy for race dialogue, unhealthy for Chris Matthews' career. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It is Friday, January 29th. I'm here with Miles O'Brien, who is filling in for John Hockenberry this morning. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, Celeste. I appreciate your enthusiasm after a long week of these hours. Let's get right to the top stories we're working this morning. Later this morning, President Obama will detail one of his new proposals to jumpstart the economy, giving small businesses a $5,000 tax credit for every new employee they hire this year. But will it work? Earlier on The Takeaway, we asked Lloyd Williams, owner of a small construction company in Baltimore, if he would hire new people if he got that tax credit.
Absolutely, absolutely. I see maybe in the very near future bringing on doubling my workforce. Right now I'm at 5, I'll go to 10.
All right, good news. But John Brown of the Brown Furniture Company in Shawnee, Oklahoma, told us he had a different take.
I'm not going to hire somebody just for a tax credit. Their salary is going to cost me a lot more than $5,000.
The president will also head to a House Republican retreat in Baltimore today, where he'll ask Republicans to work with him.
President Obama wasn't the only one making headlines yesterday following the State of the Union address. MSNBC anchor Chris Matthews caused a bit of a stir when he referenced the president's skin color, saying the president is, quote, post-racial by all appearances. You know, I forgot he was black tonight, unquote. Join us now is Gustavo Arellano of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. So, Gustavo, do you think there should be negative repercussions for Chris Matthews after that comment?
No, well, we pick on poor Chris enough because he always suffers the daily humiliation of appearing on MSNBC, so we should just leave him alone.
Gustavo Arellano at askamexican.com. No, you can't reach him there. He just writes a column. We're going to be talking to you more about this and what it means for the broader implications about race in the U.S. in just a moment. Stay with us, Gustavo. In London, Afghan President Hamid Karzai says he'll invite Taliban leaders to a tribal assembly to try to persuade them to lay down their weapons and support the government.
We must reach out to all of our countrymen, especially our disenchanted brothers, who are not part of Al-Qaeda or other terrorist networks.
This morning, Taliban leaders say they're considering the offer. In an interview with The Takeaway, General David Petraeus, the head of U.S. Central Command, told us, though the violence in Afghanistan is increasing, there's growing optimism.
There is a sense in Afghanistan. Interestingly, even some polls have showed a sense of hope among the Afghan people and so on that wasn't present before.
The second half of our interview with General Petraeus is coming up in about 30 minutes. And Lieutenant Colonel Lee Archer, an ace fighter pilot with the Tuskegee Airmen, has passed away at the age of 90. Archer shot down 5 planes during World War II. He also founded his own venture capital fund. The Tuskegee Airmen were America's first black fighter pilot group. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are down, but European indices are up and futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,120, the S&P at 1,084, and the NASDAQ at 2179. Coming up on the show, we're going to talk about movies like we have every Friday. We have a new trivia question for you, and we're going to be talking about the double stuff size of nominations for Best Picture this
kind
year.
Kind of got you verklempt there.
That's right. I'm overwhelmed by the idea of 10 nominees. We're also going to be talking about the State of the Union with you as we have all week. And we're asking you, the Grammys are this weekend, what would be the song you'd choose as the soundtrack for the State of our Union?
Nori McCord, Snailville, Georgia. My song would be Curtis Mayfield, There's a Train a-Coming.
Can't go wrong with Curtis Mayfield there. Send us your song suggestion at 8778 My Take.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, Celeste Headlee here, joined by Miles O'Brien. John Hockenberry is away today. President Obama gave his State of the Union address last night, and of course we had a lot of responses, including one from MSNBC anchor Chris Matthews, when he referenced the president's skin color in a counterintuitive attempt to show that race wasn't on his mind. He said this.
He is post-racial, by all appearances. I forgot he was black tonight for an hour.
Post-racial. That's the part of that phrase that I really want to focus on. Let's forget the other part. But let's talk about post-racial and what that even means. We're joined now by Boyce Watkins. He's a professor at Syracuse University and the founder of Your Black World Coalition. Also with us again, Gustavo Arellano of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. So welcome to you, Boyce. Boyce, let's start with you. I should mention, first and foremost, you also work sometimes as a contributor for MSNBC. That's the same network that employs Chris Matthews. So what was your reaction when you heard his comments?
Well, when he said, I almost forgot that he was a black man, as a black man, which I've been for quite a while now, I said to myself, well, what if you had remembered that he was a black man? Would that mean that his speech would have been less effective? Does that mean that that we haven't achieved certain victories in America? Does that mean that the president should be embarrassed? Does that mean that all the non-black people should run for the door? I really didn't understand what to make of Chris's statements. And even though he works with MSNBC like I do, and I knew I'd get in big trouble for talking about him too much, I had to really ask those questions. And I think Chris answered them effectively on some level. But at the same time, this idea of a post-racial America was a little bit problematic to me, as it always has been.
Okay, so Gustavo, you know, a lot of times people say that the discussion over race is hampered by the fact that people don't say what's really on their minds. Should Gustavo, do you think Chris Matthews should have edited himself?
No, I think people should always say whatever's on their mind. That said, what was on his mind was absolutely ridiculous. And the more I hear it, the more I think about it, the more sillier it is. Almost forgot. What reminded him that President Obama was a black man? Was it the color of his skin? Was it some, you know, the way he talked? As Orrin Hatch said, did he not talk enough like a Negro or whatever? It's such a silly statement. I'm at a loss of words for once.
Well, you know, we are kind of used to Chris Matthews saying at least borderline silly things. But let's take apart his use of the phrase post-racial. I'm interested in that because we're hearing it a lot, and we have been hearing it since Barack Obama became a serious candidate for president. Boyce, you know, I helped to host an event that WNYC held at the Brooklyn Museum in New York for Martin Luther King Day, and there was a large panel of scholars and thinkers talking about race, and I asked the question whether we live in a post-racial society. Here is the response from Professor Eddie Glaude of Princeton.
It's a lazy term.
Yeah.
And I think it's a term that's reflective of a sincere confusion. Something has happened, and we don't quite know how to describe it yet. So part of what I see it as is just simply a typical American effort to wrap their minds around complex matters very quickly with easy tropes.
Boyce, what do you think?
Well, I agree with Professor Glaude. I think that when you talk about a post-racial America, nobody really knows exactly what that looks like. Does a post-racial America mean that we forget that everybody's black, that blackness just sort of melts into this watered-down melting pot of assimilation and it doesn't mean anything anymore? Well, if that's what a post-racial America means, I don't really want to be a part of that. I think that being black is a beautiful thing. My concern is that I want to simply see blackness become respected. I don't want to see Obama or anybody else get elected because they're light-skinned, they don't speak with Negro dialect, as Harry Reid said, or because they are clean-cut and articulate, or the first, you know, as Joe Biden said last year. I don't want to hear people get elected in spite of the fact that they're black. I want it to be okay for someone to be black and for everyone to not simply, run off in fear because a black man is trying to be in a position of power. Because to some extent, I mean, at the end of the day, we are Americans as well. And so, this idea that one election can create an entire post-racial society and immediately erase 400 years of training in terms of treating one group of people as if they are the subordinate in the American family, that's not going to go away with one election, two elections, or 100 elections. We've got to do the hard work to fulfill Dr. King's dream.
Okay, Boyce Watkins, professor at Syracuse University. So, Gustavo Arellano, you write the column Ask a Mexican, and clearly when they say post-racial, they must be referring to lots of different races, including Hispanic. Do you think we are post-racial?
Post-racial is one of those words like proactive and zeitgeist that people who aren't smart try to use to make themselves appear to be intellectual. Post-racial is a hollow term. Obviously, as a professor was talking about, there's no way on earth that we could live in a post-racial society given the history of the United States. Not just one group at the bottom of the totem pole. There's a lot of groups at the bottom of the totem poles, and there always will be. And we do have to I think we've actually progressed pretty well as a society, given our horrible legacy of racial antagonism to the point where we're at today. But the election of one person or 10 people or nominations of God knows how many ethnic minorities to big to important positions in the United States, that doesn't mean that we're everything's now going to be hunky-dory. I don't think it ever will be, just given the human condition that insists that we have to classify people according to certain terms. And then once you're not the same like someone else, there's probably going to be antagonisms there. Although I would say here in this country, compared to others, it's getting more and more benign, those antagonisms.
Okay, that's Gustavo Arellano. He writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Boyce Watkins, you know, somebody wrote on our website, a listener wrote, being African-American, I couldn't care less about what Chris Matthews said, but this seems as if it's a discussion Caucasians have to overcome. Is there a different discussion or level of measure between what is a point of discussion about race for whites as opposed to people with brown skin?
Well, I think that people with brown skin or anybody who's not white, we need to all get together and have that conversation as a family. That's why I created the conversationonrace.com, because I wanted to promote a national conversation on race. When I talk to Reverend Al Sharpton every single week, that's one of the things that we constantly bring up, is that people do not want to talk about race in an honest and open fashion. So you must give Chris Matthews credit for at least being honest. But at the same time, once he's been honest, the question is, what now? Do we just sweep it under the rug, or do we analyze? I say we analyze, and I say we get to the heart of this issue.
That's what we're trying to do. Boyce Watkins, professor at Syracuse University and founder of Your Black World Coalition. We also heard from Gustavo Arellano of the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. And if there's anything you can count on, it's that our listeners are going to have a point of view about what we talk about, and I bet you have something to say about this issue. Let us know what it is at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the top news stories.
President Obama says he's tired of partisan politics.
Even if you disagree with me on some specific issues, all of us should be rooting for each other. All of us should be rooting for America moving forward and solving problems.
Today, the president visits a House Republican retreat in Baltimore, where he'll ask the GOP to get in the game.
I want the Republicans off the sidelines. I want them working with us to solve problems facing working families.
Also today, the president is promoting One Solution. His latest proposal gives small businesses a $5,000 tax credit for hiring new employees in 2010. Sticking with the economy now, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke won confirmation for a second four-year term yesterday. The 70-30 vote in the Senate was the closest ever for that post.
Yesterday, the United States promised to cut its greenhouse gas emissions by 17% by 2020. That's from 2005 levels. The agreement is part of the International Climate Agreement. More now on that worldwide Toyota recall. A House committee has scheduled congressional hearings for late February to talk about complaints in over faulty gas pedals in the company's vehicles. Toyota first got complaints about runaway cars years ago, as early as 2004, but they did not install brake override systems, even though other automakers did. And an update on Haiti, the U.S. Navy hospital ship Comfort is nearly at capacity. They say there are plans for a temporary hospital just outside the capital with an additional 3,000 to 5,000 beds. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, the latest from the Australian Open.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now on news stories we want you to follow. The Obama administration, we just find out, is thinking about moving the trial of the chief organizer of the September 11th terrorist attacks, that's Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and four other suspects. They may move them out of New York City. For more details, we have Benjamin Weiser with us. He's a reporter at the New York Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
So from what the last that we heard was that Mayor Bloomberg had welcomed the trial near the site of the World Trade Center, but yesterday he asked Attorney General Eric Holder to move them. Why the change?
That's true. He did switch positions on that, and after he did, it seemed to open a floodgate of more criticism. Bloomberg on Wednesday simply said it's going to cost a lot of money and disturb an awful lot of people, and he said he hoped that the Attorney General and the President decided to change their mind. Yesterday, he modified that just a little and made clear that if they didn't change their mind, he was prepared to do it in New York City, but that was clearly not his preference.
Could this possibly have been just a play to get some money out of the government?
I've heard that from critics, but I think there is genuine concern and criticism in the city from people who don't like this idea. In fact, I think they clearly have their numbers. At least the sounds have swelled, and I think he may just be either leading or joining that course.
This, obviously, the administration bet a lot. They put a lot on the line when they said they were going to make this dramatic move of holding this trial not far away from the site of the World Trade Center disaster. So wouldn't this be a huge turnabout, a loss of face for the administration?
That's a good question, and politically, I'm not sure. I mean, the courthouse here in Lower Manhattan has handled many federal terrorism trials. That's something the administration has pointed out, and yet there's no question this would be a different kind of case than they've ever seen. But the court was in the process of getting ready for this kind of thing. They've got big security plans, as do the New York City Police Department. And, of course, it'll be a big question if they do move it, where are they going to go?
And, the question when this decision was announced in the first place was that this was all up to Attorney General Eric Holder, and I assume the change of venue would also be entirely his decision, right?
He certainly made the decision to put them here, and the Obama administration yesterday, although they endorsed the idea of continuing with federal courts as opposed to military courts, did not specifically talk about location and said they were going to leave that. The president said he'd leave that to the Attorney General.
Okay, Ben Weiser, New York Times reporter, thank you so much.
Bloomberg could pay for security himself, I suppose. And now for our sports takeout, let's go to the other side of the world. Roger Federer defeated Joe Wilfried Tsonga in straight sets at the Australian Open semifinal. Here's the call from earlier this morning.
Still match point. More satisfaction than the jubilation. Yeah. He came in prepared for a fight, and he got instead a nice light hour and 28-minute sparring session.
Sports Illustrated writer John Wertheim is on location with the latest from the Australian Open. John, sounds like Federer had a relatively easy match today, straight sets. Was that expected?
No, I think he did not get as much resistance as a lot of us thought he would. He cruised through, and I mean, the good news is we have a very compelling final, but tonight's match will not be replayed as a classic.
All right, let's talk about Murray versus Federer. Andy Murray, that is, of Great Britain. Great Britain had a long drought in Grand Slam victories. Who's going to win?
That's a good question. I think Murray has a real chance. He actually has a winning record against Federer. And, it's tough to bet you don't want to bet a zero-time Grand Slam champ against a 15-time Grand Slam champ. I mean, I think Federer's the favorite. But Murray's been playing fantastically well. And I think, I think he's got a real shot here.
All right. And quickly, Serena Williams facing Justine Henin in the women's final. What are your thoughts on that one?
Another good one. I like Justine Henin, who's played a lot less tennis than Serena Williams. I think the conditions will make a difference, but Justine Henin's game is so versatile and complete. It's like nothing Serena's faced in a long time. And, it'd be a great story. This is obviously her first major back after this 18-month retirement she had. And, again, we got two great finals. So a lot of sort of strange twists and turns to get here, but we ended up with quite a nice weekend of tennis.
You bet. A fun thing to watch over the weekend. John Wertheim with Sports Illustrated. Thank you.
For our next takeout, we're going to go to you, and we've already gotten a lot of responses to the conversation about race after Chris Matthews said he forgot for a short time that the president was black while he was delivering his State of the Union speech. Here's one listener's point of view.
This is Cindy calling from Detroit.
I have yet to hear him say he is black. The media and everyone, hoo-hoo-ha-ha, our black president. Who coined the phrase, if you have a drop of black blood, you're black? Think about it, and think of what he did in history.
Well, nobody actually coined that phrase, but there were one-drop rules used to back up legislation like Jim Crow laws.
This is Mark calling from Massachusetts. Imagine if Hillary Clinton had won the election, had begun her speech, "He shall," from time to time. Do you think anyone would have said, "I forgot she was a woman"?
I don't know, maybe.
Question.
Possible, I suppose. Bill writes on our website, thetakeaway.org, Matthews could have said, "I forgot about Obama's race." I believe that's what he meant. It's like saying sometimes race seems to be an issue for some people, but tonight he didn't even think about it, period. Anyone who wants to turn their remark into anything more is just looking to start a fight, pure and simple. Well, what do you think? Are people looking to start a fight? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
We're definitely not looking to start any fights in the
We're
takeaway,
lovers,
but
not
we do
fighters.
Want
yeah.
Your responses to the State of the Union as well.
My name is Miriam Paisner from Boulder, Colorado. I noticed there was no mention whatsoever of the environment, which is collapsing. Ken Salazar is allowing the roundup of wild horses. They're proposed to reopen horse slaughterhouses in 7 states, and Obama's done nothing to stop that. I voted for Obama. I'm not sure I would do it again.
We want to thank all of you who got so involved in our State of the Union coverage, and we're still asking you to weigh in. What do you think is the soundtrack for the State of the Union? What song do you think best describes the state of the country right now?
This is Saul from White Plains, New York. The theme song for the State of the Union, Fiddler on the Roof, If I Were a Rich Man.
I wouldn't have to wear a...
Give us your song suggestion or sing it at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And here's another thing you can join in on. We're teaming up with ProPublica to find out which politicians are going to the Super Bowl, and we want to find out how they got a hold of those pricey tickets. Help us by calling your congressperson, would you? And then go to our website, thetakeaway.org, for more details.
A fine tin roof with a real wooden floor below.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
I am Celeste Headlee, but across from me is not John Hockenberry. I have Miles O'Brien with me this morning. Good morning.
It's good to be here.
We're going to have more of our conversation with General David Petraeus coming up in just a few moments. He's going to talk about the situation in Afghanistan and the state of our union. First, though, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. In the southern Afghan city of Kandahar this morning... Sounds of a fierce gun battle that broke out between a team of Taliban fighters who were targeting UN government buildings and the security forces there. 6 or 7 militants were all reportedly wearing suicide vests. They were quickly trapped on top of a building, and attack helicopters were brought in to clear them out. Meanwhile, at the border, Pakistani security officials say they've killed 30 Taliban fighters in the past 72 hours during ongoing fighting. This comes as Afghan President Hamid Karzai says he'll invite Taliban leaders to a tribal assembly to try to persuade them to lay down their weapons and support the government. The Taliban says it's considering Karzai's offer.
This morning, Bill Gates and his wife Melinda say their foundation will donate $10 billion over the next decade to research new vaccines and bring them to the world's poorest countries. And Toyota's stock fell for the 6th straight trading day in Tokyo and has lost more than 10% of its value over the past week, thanks to that expanding recall due to faulty gas pedals. Let's check the markets quickly. Asian markets down. European indices are up. Futures are up. The Dow at 10,120. The S&P opens at 1,084. The NASDAQ at 2179. Those are some of the stories we're watching.
The State of the Union.
The State of our Union.
State of the Union.
My fellow Americans, the State of our Union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
We've been talking all week about the state of our union. The president didn't talk much about foreign policy in his State of the Union address, but my co-host John Hockenberry got to ask General David Petraeus about it in his wide-ranging interview with the head of U.S. Central Command. Part one of this interview aired yesterday. In part two, John asked the general how he would characterize the state of Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen, three areas that are so much a focus in the wars on terrorism.
Well, I think probably best to as a general characterization, to describe, in a sense, the state of al-Qaeda and transnational extremist elements in the Central Command area responsibility. And we generally say that they have been diminished over the course of the last year, but without question clearly have substantial capability and are constantly adapting and trying to find some way to attack us, our partners, and important infrastructure throughout the world. If you look at Iraq, despite the continued periodic attacks, such as we saw yesterday and indeed the day before, despite all that, there has been substantial progress since the conduct of the surge. On the other hand, in Afghanistan, of course, you've seen the violence go up, went up by some 60 or so percent last year over 2008. It is remaining elevated over what it was in 2009.
I mean, in both cases, for civilians and for military personnel, worst couple of years.
Yes, without question. In fact, it got worse in terms of violence in 2008 and then in 2009. Now, having said that, there is a sense in Afghanistan. Interestingly, even some polls have showed a sense of hope among the Afghan people and so on that wasn't present before. So there is a sense of anticipation, but we have to recognize this is going to get harder before it gets easier.
That's General David Petraeus, head of U.S. Central Command, speaking to my co-host, John Hockenberry, this week in Washington. John also asked General Petraeus to respond to a comment that Defense Secretary Robert Gates made recently. Gates said al-Qaeda's mission in South Asia is to get India and Pakistan at war. Here's what General Petraeus said.
Well, frankly, those two countries have actually shown considerable restraint. I think that the response, for example, in the wake of the Mumbai attacks that were carried out by Lashkar-e-Taiba was, again, quite restrained, considering what was done and all the issues connected with this. So, first of all, I think that is something that gives us some reassurance. And Secretary Gates, I think, would say that he has reaffirmed that in his most recent of trips. I certainly have heard him talk about it. Having said that, what he has observed is undoubtedly correct, that there are elements out there, not just al-Qaeda, but perhaps as an example, Lashkar-e-Taiba and others, who would like to ignite or stoke the flames of conflict between India and Pakistan, or frankly, you know, anywhere else they can ignite, as they did in Iraq, sectarian violence, in that case between Sunni and Shia. If they could, in northern Iraq, there have been various efforts to target ethnic groups, the Turkmen, for example, Kurds and Arabs. Again, this is a thinking enemy. It's an enemy that adapts, that realizes that, okay, we may not be able to hijack another plane, so now we'll take someone and put non-metallic explosives in a place where they might not be discovered and try to do that. This is an enemy that again, continues to adjust, that does learn from what has happened, that makes much better use of, say, the internet, of cyberspace, an area that we're all going to have to come to grips with, I think, in the years ahead, as to, you know, what's the role of the military in cyberspace? You know, this is another, in a sense, arguably, it's another battlefield, but again,
sure,
but it's also an area of free speech. And so how, again, all of these...
Well, but to clarify, do you think they have the capability to bring these two nuclear nations to war, or just the intent?
No, I don't. I mean, I think, again, what Secretary Gates was getting at is right, which is that they would like to ignite, again, they'd like to ignite conflict wherever they can. They want to take down different regimes. Remember, they wanted to take down the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the keeper of the two holy mosques. They've wanted to take down governments in a host of different places. And that's what they are about in the name of religion, of course, but certainly a very, very extremist interpretation of their religion that is not shared, needless to say, by the vast, vast majority of their co-religionists.
Everyone has to ask you this. Are you planning a political career, since you've maintained such a meticulous impartiality by your own admission, not even voting since 2002, I believe. between the Republicans and the Democrats? Is that the perfect preparation for a political career for David Petraeus?
It's not. No, it's not. And I have no desire, no willingness, no nothing when it comes to any kind of political aspirations. And, you know, I did that back in 2002 in a very just, you know, it was a pretty private step to take. I have certainly read of some sort of heroes of mine when I was a younger officer that did that, and I don't put myself in their realm at all. But I thought that, you know, as you get more senior, that there, you know, you ought to try to scrupulously avoid anything that seems to be partisan. Now, that's really hard to do if you become, as I was as the commander in Iraq, the face of a policy that is certainly associated with one administration and to a degree one party.
That was General David Petraeus, head of U.S. Central Command, speaking to my co-host, John Hockenberry, on Tuesday. The full interview and the transcript is online at thetakeaway.org. That interview is part of our week-long series on the state of our union. And this week, we're asking you to expand that conversation by letting us know, what do you think is the state of our union in music? What song best describes the state of our country right now? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We talk movies every Friday, and this time we're going to talk about an expanding Oscar pool. 10 nominees for Best Picture instead of just 5.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. All this week, we've been talking about the state of our union. President Obama gave us his version on Wednesday night. Today at the Press Club in Washington, our next guest will describe the state of the Indian Union. I want to say good morning to Jefferson Keel. He's the president of the National Congress of American Indians and a member of the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma. Good morning.
Good morning.
So give us the Reader's Digest version. What is the state of the Indian Union?
Well, the state of the Indian Nations is a reflection over the past year of achievement in the Indian Nations, and it'll be a start of the next year. It'll be somewhat of a reflection of what has been accomplished in this past year, and we look toward this coming year as one of achievement, and we want to see examine what's happened in the past year and just reflect on that and give an update on where the state of the Indian Nations truly is in Indian country.
Okay, so among the Indian Nations themselves, is the state of that union strong? Are they united?
Oh, absolutely. The state of the Indian Nations are, we're proud of the growing recognition that we've had, we've been somewhat able to achieve over the past year, that particularly the recognition of the state of the nation-to-nation relationship between the Indian tribes and the United States. So it is strong, and it's growing stronger every day.
But, you know, the state of the Indian Nations and their unity hasn't always reflected this kind of gap between the needs of Indians and the what the U.S. government is willing to provide. Do you feel like that relationship is getting better, improving?
Yes, I do. You know, over the past year, as President Obama noted in his speech the other night, the Recovery Act investments have had a significant impact on not only the country, but Indian country as well. You know, tribal governments received access to some direct funding and the ability to access some important finance tools like economic development and school construction bonds. And that's helped us to restore some of the infrastructure needs that we've had in our tribal communities. And, you know, it's helped to create some jobs and allow our tribal citizens to stay and work in their own communities. And that's very important to us.
Well, you know, they began the census just this week. It began in a Native community in Alaska with the first person they counted was an elderly Inuit man. I'm wondering, is that a big push for you to make sure that the census reaches all areas of the reservation?
Oh, it's absolutely important. We need an accurate count so that the needs of Indian country can be accurately reflected. And, you know, we're often funded on the number of citizens that we have. So it's very important that we get an accurate census count. And so the National Congress of American Indians is working very hard with the Census Bureau in making sure that we get the tools and access to the information out to all of our tribal communities.
Well, I appreciate your coming in. I know you have only a couple hours left before you have to head off to the press club in Washington and give your State of the Union address. That is Jefferson Keel, president of the National Congress of American Indians, also a member of the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma. His preview of the State of the Indian Nation. You can respond with your State of the Indian Nation, the Hispanic Nation, or just the Nation Nation by giving us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Today we're asking you to kind of give us your description with using music. If you were going to make a soundtrack for the State of the Union, what would it sound like? Let us know. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Miles O'Brien, who is filling in for John Hockenberry on this Friday. Good morning. We talk about movies every Friday, and we also give our listeners a trivia question, and we do have a new one for you today. The Academy is expanding the list of nominations for Best Picture to 10 from 5. It's been 70 years since they've done that. 1943 was the last time we had 10 nominees. So we're asking you, in 1943, what film took home the Oscar for Best Picture? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And if you're really smart, name the other 9 nominees. That would really
be good. Oh, God, that would be really tough. Yeah. Without checking Wikipedia. Let's check a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. This just in, the economy grew 5.7% in the fourth quarter. That's the second straight quarter of growth, and that's the fastest growth since 2003. That's countered by news that wages and benefits rose last year by the smallest amount since records began, nearly 3 decades ago. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is planning to invite Taliban leaders to a tribal assembly to gain support for his government. He says reaching out to militants would take them out of the fight. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the U.S. would back the plan.
The United States military has been authorized to use substantial funds to support the effort, enabling our commanders on the ground to support Afghan government-led initiatives to take insurgents off the battlefield.
Today in Afghanistan, there's been a gun battle between security forces and Taliban fighters who are targeting UN and government buildings in Kandahar.
In Haiti, the United Nations held a memorial service in the capital to remember workers killed in the earthquake. And to improve aid efforts, the UN World Food Program will add 3 more distribution points today. Back home, NASA will soon get $6 billion over 5 years, the new money not enough to get the space agency back to the moon. Keith Cowing is the editor of NASAWatch.com. He says the budget proposal isn't going to please everyone.
NASA's getting more money at a time when discretionary spending is going to be frozen, so I guess you would say that's good. However, in the longer run of how where NASA is, where it needed to be, where it should be, I'm not necessarily certain it's good.
Much of the new cash would be distributed by NASA to commercial companies who would provide transportation to the International Space Station. Looking ahead to next week, top military advisors will hold a meeting about the plan to allow gays to serve openly in the military. The meeting is scheduled for Tuesday. We're joined now by Ed O'Keefe, author of the Washington Post Federal Eye blog. Ed, good to have you with us. Tell us a little bit about this meeting, and I guess a lot of people might ask, why has it taken so long for the Obama administration to do this?
Well, this is a previously scheduled Senate Armed Services Committee hearing. They would be talking about President Obama's proposed budget for the Pentagon. And right after they have that budget discussion, they're going to have Admiral Mullen and Defense Secretary Robert Gates stick around for about an hour to talk about what it might take to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell military policy. Senator Carl Levin, who's the chairman of the committee, is a big supporter of repealing it. He told reporters earlier this week that the White House had asked him to wait, hold this hearing after the State of the Union, suggesting that the president would call for a repeal, which he did. And now we're expected to hear next week from the Pentagon on sort of their path forward and what they would do in the process of repealing the policy.
All right. Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been around now since 94. I think 13,000 members of the service have had to leave on account of this. Is there still a lot of resistance to the idea of allowing gays to serve openly?
Though they don't talk about it publicly, it's believed that a bunch of the top military brass still have issues with this. I think they're more concerned with the implementation of a repeal. But generally, there is broad support across the country, across the political spectrum, to get rid of it.
Ed O'Keefe with the Washington Post Federal Eye blog. Thank you. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
We talk about movies on The Takeaway on Fridays, and today's topic is the huge pool of Best Picture Oscar nominees. On Tuesday, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences will announce this year's nominations, and for the first time in 70 years or so, there will be 10 nominees for Best Picture instead of 5. Rafer Guzman is the film critic for the New York Newsday, and A.O. Scott is film critic for the New York Times. Good morning to both of you. A.O., why? Why double the size of the nominations?
Well, in recent years, the ratings for the broadcast have been, you know, sort of steadily eroding, and there's a sense, and it's very important that that Oscar night broadcast and bringing in a bigger audience. And one of the reasons that it's speculated, at least, is that the movies that have been nominated have been some of the less widely commercial, mass-marketed blockbuster movies. That it's been sort of smaller movies. A couple years ago, you had No Country for Old Men, for example, in a race against There Will Be Blood. Both of the companies that released those movies no longer exist, partly because of the expense of marketing movies like that for Oscars. And then last year, there was a great hue and cry when The Dark Knight didn't get a Best Picture nomination. So I think some of the thinking was if they can bring in more of the popular movies that audiences really liked during the year, at least fold them into this field of 10, then that will bring some of the audiences who like those movies to the show.
Well, it seems odd because we know movies like Avatar and Up in the Air are going to get a nod in the nominations. But, you know, Rafer, I'm wondering, maybe this doubling the size of the nominee pool will allow us to get things like this in there.
My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I want to be on the cover of a magazine. I wish I had a light-skinned boyfriend with real nice hair. But first, I want to be in one of them BET videos.
That's Precious that we just heard.
Yeah, Precious.
I think that will definitely be in there. I think there's some talk that a movie like Serious Man might go in there, a movie like An Education, which was also a small, you know, limited release film. I think that'll go in. I think what the president of the Academy had said when he made the announcement was that there might be a chance that you'll see things like comedies, which often go overlooked. You get things like that in there. That's why I think people were very surprised when The Hangover won the Golden Globe for Best Comedy. So now I think there's this question. Seems a little unlikely, but there's this question: are we going to have The Hangover rubbing shoulders with The Hurt Locker?
I bet we could take some good odds on that. But A.O., what nominations do you think might surprise us this year?
Well, I think there's some I think what's funny about the 10 picture race is it's still going to come down to probably, you know, two or three that are really in contention, probably Avatar, Hurt Locker and Up in the Air, that have been in the sort of preliminary awards, you know, doing very well. And I don't think when they were planning this, the Academy knew that the Avatar phenomenon was coming down the pike. Yes, I think we might have. I think the Hangover is a possible sort of surprise, because sometimes comedies get nominated. Very rarely does this kind of, you know, raunchy, vulgar, R-rated sex comedy get nominated. I think, you know, another possible surprise would be District 9, which was a sort of a hit last summer, kind of, you know, science fiction allegory plot, rather similar, oddly, to Avatar. Maybe some of the smaller ones that Rafer mentioned. I think that there will be more emphasis, though, on popularity and on movies that made money. I think another one that could sneak in addition to the Best Actress nominee it's sure to get is The Blind Side, starring Sandra Bullock.
Big Mike, why were you going to the gym?
Because it's warm.
Do you have any place to stay tonight? Don't you dare lie to me.
Okay, and Rafer, who might get snubbed?
Who might get snubbed? You know, that's a good question. I think Crazy Heart might get snubbed for a Best Picture nomination. I think Jeff Bridges is clearly in the running, possibly the front runner for the Best Actor. I don't know if I've heard a lot of buzz in terms of Crazy Heart getting the Best Picture nomination.
Okay, well, let's go to our trivia question. It has been about 70 years or so since we had 10 nominees for Best Picture, 1943. What film took home the top honors of the year? Tony Scott?
I'm going to just embarrass myself and lose all my credibility. I don't know. Mrs. Miniver was the year before, I think.
Rafer, any ideas?
I do know. It's Casablanca.
Casablanca.
No. He's looking at you, kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the iconic best picture ever. Rafer Guzman, Takeaway film contributor, critic for Newsday, and also thanks to A.O. Scott, film critic for our partner, The New York Times. You know, we've been talking about the State of the Union all week long, and we're wondering, what is your soundtrack for the State of the Union? Is there a song that best describes the state the country is in right now? I chose Understand. That's a song that's out of a band that most people don't know, but here's one that we got a suggestion from one of our listeners.
This is James from Detroit, and my theme song for the State of the Nation would be Crooked Fingers' Big Carcass.
Dead in the sun and covered in glue, there is a town where nothing moves. Nobody works, and nobody plays, and all of their dreams.
That's a big darkness if you couldn't understand what he was saying. We're anxious to hear your song suggestions, or if you want to sing it to us, call 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Happy Friday. I'm Celeste Headlee.
They say a hero's coming soon, with ivory lungs like huge balloons. There ain't no moon, and there ain't no stars.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.